Not because I understand it, but they know I can't respond. Not really. People in India always say Urdu is this sweet language of poetry, but to me, Urdu just sounds like my parents. She can't go. She has to stay close to home. This is your fault, you know. You're the one who got her that dumb camera, always encouraging her. My mom is in free fall. I knew we gave her too much freedom, always letting her do whatever she wants, never taking her to the mosque. John, John, calm down. My dad tries to pacify my mother, but the bulging vein in his forehead tells me he is far from relaxed. Let her explain. Maybe this is a phase. He turns toward me. The English language and I reappear in the conversation. I don't understand how you simply lied so easily and applied to NYU and now expect us to say, okay, go ahead. This isn't just a matter of money, Maya. You know that.
Dad, I'm sorry. I should have told you, but I made a spur-of-the-moment decision to apply. I didn't dream I'd get in, and you're so adamantly against it. I did tell Hina and...
The blurter emerges. It's a mistake to implicate my aunt. Now my mom looks upset. She turns her fiery gaze on Hina.
You encouraged her? My sister and my daughter lying to me. What did I do to deserve this?
My mom yells as her eyes grow shiny with tears.
It's not Hina's fault. I...
It's okay. Hina puts her hand on my arm and interjects. I did support her decision. I do. Maya has a talent. You don't want her to waste a gift from God now, do you?
Oh, don't you start as if you are so biased, Mom snaps. Maya got this defiance from you. You set a terrible example.
Hina lets the words wash right over her. She is serene. Appa, do you pray 5 times a day? Regularly?
I... Well, you know, each night I pray for Maya. Obviously, I have not been doing a good job.
I throw up my hands.
What does praying have to do with going to NYU anyway? I'm not modern or whatever because of Hina. I'm the way I am because I live now, in the 21st century, in America, and I want to make movies.
My eyes are wide. I'm rebelling. I'm going to be a Desi movie-making rebel, just like Deepa Mehta. Of course, I could never mention her name as a role model, because even though Water was tragic and beautiful and amazing and got an Oscar nomination, it caused riots in India, and she got death threats. Not the image I want my parents to associate with me being a director. Mom's expression grows bitter.
I really should have sent you to boarding school in India.
Everyone calm down, my dad urges. Sophia, you're going to raise your blood pressure. And Maya, you need to listen.
Why can't you trust me?
I ask him point blank.
Beta.
My dad tempers his voice.
It's not that we don't trust you. Your ummi worries what will happen to you if you go far away from home.
That's right.
Mom sniffs and dabs her eyes with her napkin. You know, we're always hearing stories of our girls who live far from their parents and go with these boys and get into trouble. Some of them even eat pork. I stifle a laugh. Laughing would definitely not be appropriate right now, but I'm not sure how the apparently cardinal sin of eating pork equates with the kind of trouble you can get into with boys. Say, premarital sex.
But in my mom's logic, it does. Mom, you know I'm not like that. I never go wild and eat pepperoni pizza. I don't even break curfew.
But what if something happens to you?
My father asks.
We don't have any relatives in New York. Who will help you?
I guess I'll need to help myself, I say, and then quickly add, plus, Kareem is only a couple hours away at Princeton. I know I can call him for anything. He told me so. My mother perks up at the sound of Kareem's name. Matchmaking hope springs eternal in the Desi Muslim mom's imagination. But how will it look if we send you away by yourself? A girl? Look to who? I ask. The community, my mom says. You know how people talk.
What people?
Hina jumps in. Your friends? Your family? Appa, this isn't back home. And it's not the same as it was 20, 30 years ago, even in India. She offers a sly smile. Look at me, the heathen. I live on my own, and you haven't disowned me yet. My mother allows herself a smile, but then adds, You're my sister. I love you, but you're not... not...
I'm not married. You don't want Maya to be too independent like me? Well, I'm happy, if that matters to you. I have a great life and great friends, and I love being a graphic designer. I designed a banner that's hanging from every lamppost in downtown Chicago to raise money and awareness for breast cancer. And I'm proud of that. I hope Maya can have all the things that make her happy and more. And if she wants to get married, that should be her choice.
I squeeze my aunt's hand. It's escaped me how truly rebellious Hina's life really is, as far as Desi Muslim standards go, even by American-born confused Desi Muslim standards. Hina is 40-something, single, childless, and lives by herself. She's not just a rebel, she's a pioneer. What a lonely road it must have been for her to travel.
Of course, Hina,
my dad says softly, attempting again to soothe the flaring tempers.
We want Maya to be happy in her life, and you are a wonderful aunt. But we made our wishes very clear to Maya. She should have voiced her objections then, not after the fact.
Yes, Bhaijaan. Hina addresses him with the very respectful brother dear in Urdu. You are her parents, and I understand your wishes. But remember how your own parents felt when you were coming to America? They didn't want you to go, but you wanted to do what was best for your family and your future. And Maya wants... I remember very well how heartbroken our Ami was at the airport. My mom interrupts. But I was much older than Maya. You are actually only a little older than Maya is now, my dear sister, Hina points out. And Hyderabad is a lot farther from Illinois than Illinois is from New York. And don't forget, you waited a long time to have a kid, despite our Ami's pressure. My mom narrows her eyes at Hina. That was a decision between husband and wife. Why are you bringing up this ancient history? Because it's important. Because a marriage certificate doesn't bestow maturity. And even you have to admit that Maya is much savvier than you were at her age. Let her find her new world, too, as you did all those years ago. I'm in awe of my aunt's alchemy with words. It truly is magic. As Hina speaks, my parents' faces relax, grow wistful, as they remember when they were young and full of dreams. I hesitate, but I take a chance and break the moment of calm. I'm asking for the chance to follow my passion. If I don't take it now, I'm afraid I'll regret it one day. And I promise, if I hate it or don't have the talent they seem to think I might, I'll switch majors to a more practical one. I reach across the table and place my hand on my mother's. But not pre-med. You know I can't stand blood. This makes them laugh. I'm winning my case. But if I'm going to suck all the marrow out of this bone, I need to hear them say the words. And I promise, if you let me go, I'll call home all the time, and I won't turn into an ungrateful, pork-eating, miniskirt-wearing... Hina puts her hand on my knee to stop my compulsive talking. It's too bad I won't be able to take her with me if this works out.
Veitha, you know we want what is best for you.
My dad looks at my mom as he says this. He's caving. I can see it in his face. Finally, he turns to me.
What is the timeline for deciding?
May 1st. That is this Thursday. My mom yelps. Maya! I'm sorry. I know I should have told you earlier, but I wasn't sure how. I thought you'd be so mad you'd hate me.
I am mad. But how can I hate you? You're my daughter.
Your dad is right. We want what is best for you. We want you to be happy.
My mom and dad look at each other, then at me. Something passes between them in that look. Some kind of silent communication married people share. And Hina's right. Maybe I'll be able to share that sort of glance with my own husband one day, but on my terms. My mom stands up from the table.
The food has gone cold now. Let me reheat it.
She sighs.
I guess you are your father's daughter, always wanting to see new things.
The morning light streams into the kitchen. I don't think any one of us slept. It's clear in our bleary eyes and sluggish movements and hesitant syllables. All of yesterday's dishes are still in the sink.
Maya, you left food on that plate. You have to rinse it properly before putting it in the dishwasher,
my mom reminds me. After Hina left, my parents didn't say another word to me about NYU. They didn't say another word to me, period. Mostly, they were huddled in their room, presumably talking about me. But there weren't any raised voices, so I took that as a hopeful sign. Sorry, Mom. I'm not going to argue that our new dishwasher is connected to the garbage disposal, so we don't have to be all old school about loading the dishes. There were little cracks in the parental college resolve last night, and I know what Hina would advise, so I try to channel her patience and understanding of my parents' anxieties. My dad is at the table, drinking chai. Out of the corner of my eye, I spy my parents steal another one of those silent, meaningful looks at each other. My dad gives my mom a wan smile.
If you're going to be on your own, you can't eat off dirty plates, God help you.
My mom shakes her head. On my own? You mean... I turn to look at my mom, who just shrugs. Dad? Does that... I can go? To NYU? My dad nods once. I'll remember this nod forever. I turn from the sink, wipe my hands on my jeans, and wrap my arms around his neck, and whisper a thank you. I look at my feet. They are still on the floor. I don't know how this is possible. My dad strokes my hair. It's been a long time since I've allowed that to happen. It grounds me. I am here. This is happening. I walk back to the sink to hug my mom. My dad clears his throat.
Your mom is right. Just because you're going to be far away doesn't mean you can eat off filthy dishes and whatnot.
I have a feeling we are not talking about clean dishes anymore, but I add extra dish soap to the sponge to get every speck of food off the plates, just in case. I nod and let my dad continue.
When you're in the dorm, you will treat it just like you are in this house. All the same rules apply. Do you understand?
Yes, Dad. I smile, nod, and continue loading the dishes.
That means you are going there to study, and that's it.
We want you to make friends, too, my mom adds. Nice ones. Girls. And maybe you can join the Muslim Students Association. You know, Yasmin told me all about the one at her college. She organized their Eid party. It sounds perfect for you. You could film all the events. I bite my tongue. Literally, I bite down on the tip of my tongue to stop the words that are about to roll off it. My muscles tense, but I keep a smile on my face. That's a great idea, Mom. My mom turns to my dad and nods, clearly pleased with herself.
Maya, your mom and I are giving you permission to go to NYU, but don't think this means you can go behind our backs again. No more surprises.
My dad pauses and gives my mom that silent look again that tells her to continue while he leaves the kitchen. Just before he walks out, he kisses me on the top of the head. Approval. You understand what your dad is saying, right? You're growing up. You need to be careful, especially when you're on your own. Especially with boys. You see what I'm saying? Yes, Mom. I promise. I'll focus on my studies. No surprises. I'll make you proud. I don't know what else to say, because of course I'm going to go out, and I hope there will be boys, or a boy at least. Maybe even one here. But my assurances appease my mom, even if they feel false to me. I will study. I do hope I make them proud. But this is my first taste of adventure, and as Kareem might say, I'm going to carpe the hell out of every diem. Maya Aziz, beyond Batavia. I can't wait to tell Kareem I did it. And Phil. I want to tell him, too. But I'll think about that awkwardness later. For now, I want to revel in the happiness that fizzes inside me. New York. New life. My parents' change of heart has to be a sign of good things to come. Maybe Phil's not in my future, but my other dreams can be. They already are. I tell my mom I can finish up in the kitchen, but she doesn't move. When I turn to look at her, she's gazing at me with tears welling in her eyes. Mom? What's wrong?
Nothing, Beta. You're growing up. Hino is right. You are a wonderful young woman. May God grant you a long life and every happiness.
I step over to her and hug her, my soapy hands gripping on the floor. She steps back.
I have to take the nazar off you.
Mom, it's okay. No one gave me the evil eye. I'm good. My whole life, any time I had any sort of school achievement, or even when I get what my mom refers to as compliments of envy, or especially when I would suddenly get sick, my mom would take the nazar off, sometimes preemptively. Don't fight her on her superstitions, I say to myself. WWHD. What would Hina do? Hina would quietly give my mom this little victory to assuage her concerns. I walk over to the fridge, take out an egg, and hand it to my mom. She carefully takes it in her right hand and sweeps it over my head while she recites a quiet prayer, asking God to remove the evil eye and keep me under his protection. The whole ritual takes barely 2 minutes, and it gives her peace of mind. She smiles and hands me the egg.
Now go put it outside in the pot with the jasmine plant. I'll bury it later. Be careful.
I got it, Mom. Don't worry. My mom goes to join my dad in the living room. I start for the back door, but I lose my footing and slip on the sudsy water I dripped all over the floor when I hugged my mom. I throw my arms out to balance myself so I don't fall on my ass. I'm impressed with my cat-like recovery, but sticky egg white and yolk drip down my fingers because in my effort not to fall, I've crushed the egg in my hand. I can imagine my mom's freak out if she'd witnessed this sacrilege, so I quickly wash off in the sink and sweep up any remaining eggshell and dump it into the sink. I turn the water on and run the garbage disposal. My mom got the calm that came with the ritual, so I'm not going to tell her about this. What she doesn't know can't hurt her. Cautiously, he slides out of his parking spot. The moment before, just before, he panics. She makes him hesitate. A small, dark-haired girl holding her mother's hand, looking up at her, a smile like sunshine, her dress red as a poppy bursting against green grass. Collateral damage. Sweat drips off the hook of his nose. He bites his cheek, hard. Blood fills his mouth. At least now they will know his name. His right foot bears down hard on the accelerator. Chapter 12. Violet fills the ride to school with spring break tales of kissing Parisian boys and exploring the villages of Côte d'Azur. I nibble on the rose-scented macaron she brought me from Paris. But for once, I share stories too. Good ones, great ones, life-altering ones. The stuff origin stories are made of. I devour the last macaron as we turn down Senior Hall. That's when I see Amber and Kelsey, two of Lisa's best friends, leaning against my locker, arms crossed in front of their chests, scowling. They both wear their matching cinnamon brown manes in perfect shiny ponytails that would make my mom weep with joy. We've been in school together since sixth grade, and in that entire time, I've probably exchanged 15 words with both of them combined. If that. You can usually find them huddled with Lisa every morning, laughing or gossiping until Lisa breaks away to walk to class with Phil. When they see me, their scowls only deepen. They both straighten up. My laughter comes to an abrupt halt. Amber steps forward with one hand on her jutting right hip as Violet and I approach my locker. She stares down at me. "You know what I think?" she begins. "That your parents shouldn't have given you a stripper name," Violet responds. I stifle an anxious chuckle because Violet always has my back, but sometimes she escalates before I even know if the situation calls for escalation. Amber's mouth opens to a perfect O of surprise. I put my hand on Violet's elbow and pull her back a couple inches. "What do you guys want?" I ask. I notice we are drawing the attention of a few people in the hall. Luckily, it's still a bit early, so Senior Hall isn't at full capacity. Amber clears her throat and tries again, face sour, jaw tight. "Maya, don't even think about going to prom with Phil." I laugh out loud. I expected them to hurl homewrecker insults at me, so this is actually a relief. "That's why you came over here? All shirty?" What's shirty? Kelsey asks, disgusted.
Violet speaks up before I can respond.
It's none of your damn business who Maya goes to prom with.
Wait, why are you even bringing this up? Isn't Phil taking Lisa to prom? I ask. My heart starts beating faster.
Amber and Kelsey look at each other nervously. Amber shrugs and lowers her voice.
They broke up.
The news strikes me like an anvil. Truly, I'm not sure if I should be thrilled or ready myself for a shitstorm. Maybe both.
Violet doesn't immediately respond either, so I know she's in at least as much shock as me.
Kelsey fills the silence.
Phil promised Lisa he wouldn't go to prom with anyone else, so Maya can't go with him.
She pauses, straightens her shoulders, and adds,
"We came to warn you."
My brain is still spinning. Violet steps into Kelsey's personal space. Kelsey stumbles back a step. Violet is at least a couple inches taller than Kelsey, and far scarier. Now everyone is watching. I feel like I've crossed into some surreal world that I can't wrap my mind around. But right now, my only job is to make sure this absurd scene doesn't turn into some ridiculous faux girl gang turf war. So I pull Violet away and step in front of her.
I have no idea why you felt this strange compulsion to tell me this, but whatever, you did. Now, can you get out of the way? I have to get to class.
You can't go with him, Amber says. Final word.
Violet's eyes blaze.
Leave Maya out of your psychodrama, freaks.
We watch them turn and walk away, vanishing around the corner. Other students turn back to their lockers, and the hall fills again with post-vacation catch-up chatter. I quickly scan the hall. No sign of either Phil or Lisa, thankfully. Violet and I look at each other, eyes wide. I mouth the words, "Oh my God." She gives me this huge grin and a classic eye twinkle. She leans in and whispers,
"It's so on."
Bonjour, ça va?
Madame Dupont greets us at the door. Her lilting accent never fails to capture the music of the language.
Bonjour, madame,
Violet and I reply. My own accent is always a little too chirpily American. The rest of the students file in and take their seats. Madame Dupont walks to the front of the class.
Cette semaine, j'ai une petite surprise pour vous. Nous allons regarder un film,
she says, taking a DVD off her desk and popping it in the player. Turning back to the class, she smiles and continues.
Et il y aura un test jeudi.
The class groans.
Je vous présente Paris, je t'aime.
I check to make sure my phone is turned off. I hate when people forget to turn their phones off during the movies. Nothing pulls you out of your suspension of disbelief faster than a stupid ringtone.
I've missed a text.
From Phil. Actually, three of them.
Phil. I'm sorry about Amber and Kelsey.
Phil.
I should have told you.
Phil.
Can we talk?
Is it possible to be happy and angry at the same time about the same thing? I tap Violet on the shoulder and show her my screen. But before I can say anything, the teacher gives me the stink eye.
Mademoiselle Aziz, s'il vous plaît,
she says in a clipped tone as she motions for me to put my phone away. Phil will have to wait.
Good.
Madame Dupont turns off the lights. The movie begins. The soft, bluish glow of the television soothes me. I've already seen the movie. It's an anthology, a little collection of vignettes about life in Paris, each taking place in a different quarter of the city. My favorite is the one set in the 14th arrondissement. It's a short film that follows a middle-aged postal worker on her first trip to Paris. But the conceit of the film is that it feels like a documentary, even though it isn't. It makes the character's story so much more poignant. She narrates the whole piece like it's an essay for a French class. And what I really love about it is the mood. She just feels so alone, like she's lived her whole life in quiet desperation, as Thoreau would say, instead of sucking the marrow out of life. And it should be super depressing. It is, kind of. But there's this little moment where she feels joy and sadness at the same time. And what she realizes is that you can find life even when you think it eludes you.
Lockdown.
It's the principal's voice barking over the intercom.
All students are to remain in their classes. Teachers, begin lockdown procedures. This is not a drill. The all clear will sound when the lockdown is over.
Madame Dupont rises from her desk. She hurries to lock the classroom door so it can't be opened from the outside. We all straighten up from our comfortable movie-watching positions, looking around the room wild-eyed. I am among the we, but I am also just me, detached. Everyone speaks at once, or some of us. I am silent. Madame Dupont doesn't immediately shush us. She runs her hand over her face, trying to conceal her worry, as she stands at the door, looking out the slim glass window. I sneak a peek around her. A couple security guards rush through the hallways, walkie-talkies in hand. Madame Dupont turns off the DVD. The lights stay off.
What's going on?
Someone shouts.
You know as much as I do.
She switches to English, her voice calm and commanding.
You heard the principal. Now I need all of you to move your desks to the left. It's going to be close quarters for a while. I want to make sure that no one can see you from the window in the door.
Metal desk legs screech against the floor. Students bump into one another. Backpacks fall with the thud of heavy textbooks. Madame Dupont cuts copy paper in half lengthwise and proceeds to paper over the skinny glass window in the door. She leaves a small flap untaped so she can check out the window if necessary.
Why are you doing that?
Brian yells from the back row. He's usually quiet in class, especially lately. I don't turn to look. To be honest, I've been completely avoiding looking in his direction since that weirdness at the bookstore.
So no one can see in to shoot us, duh!
Jessica yells at him from the front row.
Shh!
Madame Dupont says.
There's not going to be any shooting. It's a precaution. Now, we're going to stay in here until we get the all clear. No one leaves and no one comes in, understand?
We all nod.
We don't have the facts, so let's not speculate. The best thing for us to do is stay calm. I'm going to turn the movie back on, and you'll have more information as soon as I will, when the principal announces it.
Madame Dupont hits play on the remote, and the movie resumes. I almost lose myself in the dreamy soundtrack, until the cacophony of discordant ringtone starts. All at once, everyone has their phones in their faces. The uproar is loud and immediate.
There's been a terrorist attack,
one student yells out.
It's in Springfield,
adds another. Madame Dupont turns to her computer. A handful of students gather around her desk, searching for more information. One student tries to get reception on the cableless television. The information and misinformation comes in fits and starts. A bomb exploded at the federal building in Springfield. Homeland Security has issued a red alert for the entire state of Illinois. There's a shooter. No, it's a suicide bomber. A plane is missing. There are dozens of victims. Wrong. Hundreds are dead. It's a truck bomb. It's poison gas. The building was leveled. The National Guard is being called up. The army has been deployed. The president has moved to an undisclosed location. All schools and government buildings are on lockdown. No one is allowed in or out. Parents are at the school doors demanding to get their kids. Police are stationed at the entrances of the high school. There's a steady flow of news and innuendo, and it's hard to discern the truth. I'm frozen. My fingers curl tightly around my phone. The entire room is in chaos, but I see the action as if through the blades of a whirring fan, disjointed and surreal. My stomach lurches. A terrorist attack. Another tragedy. Is there no end? Is this how life will always be? I want to know more, but there is one piece of information I absolutely hope I don't hear. I whisper a prayer to the universe. Please, please let everyone be okay. Please don't let it be a Muslim. I know I'm not the only one hoping for this. I know millions of American Muslims, both religious and secular, are echoing these very same words at this very same moment. I know I'm not a very good Muslim, but I hope my prayers are heard. Prayers for the dead and wounded. Prayers for ourselves. Prayers for peace, hoping that no more lives are lost to hate. I'm scared. I'm not just scared that somehow I'll be next. It's a quieter fear and more insidious. I'm scared of the next Muslim ban. I'm scared of my dad getting pulled into secondary security screening at the airport for random questioning. I'm scared some of the hijabi girls I know will get their scarves pulled off while they're walking down a sidewalk. Or worse. I'm scared of being the object of fear and loathing and suspicion again. Always. I remember my parents telling me about how devastating 9/11 was. How those burning buildings and all the posters of missing people are seared in their memories forever. Hina thinks that was the tipping point, when the Islamophobia went mainstream and became fodder for campaign slogans. It left American Muslims to fight for their Americanness and their beliefs. I know what Hina says about all of it, about not giving in to fear. I'm trying to hold on to that. Violet touches my shoulder. Are you okay? I jerk upright. Yeah, I'm worried. I can't believe... I'm sure we're fine, she interrupts in a rush. They're probably going crazy overboard with security. I doubt Batavia is high on the terrorist target list. There is Fermilab. Violet stares at me, her eyes wide. Oh. My. God. I didn't even think of that. But they don't store weapons. It's physics research. It's a government facility. I'm guessing terrorists don't sweat the details. I'm calling my dad, she says. As I watch Violet dial, I'm painfully aware that I haven't thought of calling my own parents. I look at my phone and see several missed calls from all their numbers. Worst-case scenarios no doubt colonize my mom's head. I call the office. No answer. I call home. Mom picks up. She speaks before I can even say hello. We've been calling and calling you. Sorry, Mom. My phone was on silent. The school is on lockdown. Yes, Beta. We know. We called the front office. They say they will probably let you out soon. They want to make sure that everything is okay before releasing students from school. Can you believe this? It's horrible. What are they saying on the news?
They still don't know what happened or who is responsible.
But it seems that a suicide bomber blew himself up inside the federal building in Springfield. They don't know much more. It's terrible. They are still trying to get people out of the building. Do they know if the bomber is... if he was... I don't want to say it out loud. No. Nothing yet. My mom doesn't want to say it out loud either. Those poor, poor people who died. I'm going to pray for them. Your dad is coming to get you. No, it's okay. He doesn't need to. They still haven't said when they're letting us out, and I can get a ride with Violet.
Okay. Call us if you want. The school secretary said the lockdown is a precaution.
Don't be scared. I'm not scared.
I lie because my mother's concern annoys me.
I know it shouldn't. She's a parent. She's my parent. Worry and love are part of the package. But to me, it feels smothering.
Okay.
We'll see you soon, then.
Let us know when they let you go.
Okay. Khudafiz.
Khudafiz.
Violet puts down her phone at the same time.
My dad says they evacuated all the buildings at Fairmead. There's police at all the entrances, and apparently there is going to be the army or the National Guard, too. He's at home already.
My parents are home, too.
After a few more interminable minutes, there's a loud knock at the door. The room falls silent, and we all instinctively scoot as far from the door as possible.
Madame Dupont walks to the door and asks who it is, carefully lifting a free corner of the paper taped over the slim window. She opens the door to a security guard. He hands her a piece of paper and asks her to keep the door locked with everyone in the room until there is an announcement. The classroom is completely silent. Madame Dupont's black heels click against the floor as she walks to the front of the classroom, paper in hand.
It looks like the information we were getting on the internet was correct, in part. There was a bombing at the federal building in Springfield. At this time, they think a suicide bomber drove a vehicle past the security gates and straight through the front doors of the building. There is no word on the number of people killed. They are still sorting through the rubble.
We stare at Madame Dupont. The class is completely quiet. A couple students cry. Someone finally asks, "Are we under attack?"
"That's all the information we have so far," Madame Dupont says. "It's a Muslim terrorist," Brian yells. "They hate America."
I turn to look at Brian. He stares right back. His glare is icy and unnerving, and he mutters something under his breath.
"I need you all to stay calm," Madame Dupont snaps. "Like I said, it doesn't help to speculate."
I turn to face forward. Madame Dupont raises an eyebrow.
"Understand? All of you? I'm sure the authorities will release information when they have it. Now, as far as lockdown, there should be an announcement soon to dismiss everyone. They are going to let you out by class. The freshmen will be first, the sophomores next. If you take a bus home, all the buses will be lined up at the front of the building, waiting for you. If you drive, please go to your cars and leave the back parking lot immediately. No loitering." It takes almost 30 minutes to get to us. We all hurry to Senior Hall, rushing by the grim faces of the school staff that line the corridors. Police and school security roam the halls. Senior Hall hums, the air thick with anxiety.
We gather up our books and follow the stream of seniors exiting the hallway. I see Lisa at Phil's locker, sobbing, her head buried in his chest. Phil has one arm against her upper back and his other stiff at his side. Our eyes meet. He holds my gaze. A vice clamps its jaws around my heart. The scene is a perfect metaphor. Phil stands at the edge of the frame in the film of my life, slightly out of focus. There's a girl in his foreground, but it's not me. The distance between us ever widening. I hook my arm through Violet's. As we walk down the hall, I have the distinct sense that we're leaving a tiny, crumbling world behind us. We step outside into the brash light of another world I can't possibly understand. The special agent in charge, the man in a dark blue windbreaker with FBI emblazoned along the sleeve and back of the jacket, steps up to the podium. Now, I'll take any questions. Question. Do you have any more information on the white truck that was at the scene before the bombing? Answer. We have a partial on the license plate from a security camera across the street. It appears that the truck drove through the security gate at 1310 hours and directly into the building before exploding. Question. Can you confirm that an Egyptian passport was found at the scene? Answer. Yes. It appears to belong to one Kamal Aziz. Question. Is he a suspect? Answer. He is currently under investigation as a person of interest. We are working to positively ID his body and determine if he was indeed the driver of the vehicle. Question. Has any terrorist group taken credit for the bombing? Answer. At this time, there are no claims of responsibility. We are still looking into any possible ties between Aziz and known terrorist organizations or splinter groups. We are also working to determine any accomplices or known associates who may still be at large. We urge the public to contact us at the investigation hotline with any relevant tips or information. Finally, let me assure the public that we will leave no stone unturned in our search for those who committed this heinous act. Chapter 13. Carnage leaps, bleeding from the television screen. Over and over on the news, it's the same image. The massive, neoclassical building that used to take up an entire city block. One third of it has been sheared off by the strength of the bomb. It looks like a giant meteor crashed through the roof, obliterating stone into dust. Bent steel beams and the pulpy ends of impossibly twisted floors are all that remain. I sit on the edge of the sofa, my fingers digging into the fabric. Waves of nausea prevent me from eating anything but saltines and ginger ale. Death is everywhere, and the pit in my stomach grows and grows. The 10 o'clock nightly news confirms my quiet worry. The FBI holds a press conference at the site, corroborating hearsay that a passport found at the crater belonged to Kamal Aziz, an Egyptian national. They believe he is the suicide bomber. It's selfish and horrible, but in this terrible moment, all I want is to be a plain old American teenager who can simply mourn without fear, who doesn't share last names with a suicide bomber, who goes to dances and can talk to her parents about anything and can walk around without always being anxious, and who isn't presumed a terrorist first and an American second. I sleep deeply, without dreams, but when I wake up, I feel like I haven't rested at all. There is a dull ache in the marrow of my bones. I trudged down the stairs for breakfast, trying to stomp out the self-hate and the doubt. I do not want to go to school.
I made pancakes,
my mom says, lifting a lid from a plate on the table.
They're still warm.
Her face shows her hope that food will snap me out of my mood. But it's not a mood. It's my life.
Oh, I'm not hungry,
I say, trying to sound as diplomatic as possible.
But you have to eat, she pleads.
She looks so crushed. I plop down in the chair and consent to eat one pancake.
Are you okay, Beta?
My mom asks, never able to provide silence when I need it.
I'm fine. Why?
Even my syllables sound worn out.
Your face looks so tired.
I apologize for offending your aesthetic sensibilities. Maybe I should have put makeup on before coming down to breakfast.
No reason to take it that way, Maya.
My father's voice edges into impatience.
We're worried about you.
Sorry I'm not Miss Mary Sunshine, but a so-called Muslim sociopath attacked us. Again. If these jerks hate America so much, why don't they stay in their own countries?
He killed little kids.
My voice breaks. I don't understand that kind of hate.
It's a terrible tragedy. It's a sin. You know the Quran says that whoever takes a life of an innocent, it's as if he has killed all of mankind.
And if anyone saves a life, it's as if he saved all of mankind. I know. But how is that supposed to change anything? How are we supposed to change anything? My hands shake. My father picks up where my mother leaves off.
These terrorists are the antithesis of Islam. They're not Muslim. Violence has no place in religion, and the terrorists are responsible for their own crimes, not the religion and not us.
Then why is there so much fighting in the Middle East? And why are so many suicide bombers Muslim?
Terrorism has no religion. Think about Dylan Roof and that church in Charleston, or the attack at the Sikh Gurdwara in Wisconsin. Terrorists have their own ideology. Who knows what hatred compels them? They're desperate and unthinking and ignorant followers.
I interrupt my mother. Too bad none of that matters. We all get painted like we're un-American and terrorist sympathizers, no matter how loudly we condemn terrorism and say it's un-Islamic. It's guilt by association.
Yes, Beta. But our friends, the community, they know we are good people.
My father explains what I already know, but in my rage against the bomber, I can't hold on to the truth of what he says.
There is going to be a prayer at the mosque tonight for the victims of the bombing. We'll also be doing a fundraiser.
We want you to come, my mom says. We will leave at 7. You barely make me go to the mosque, except for religious holidays or weddings. My father's face falls as he looks at my mom.
Maybe we should have been going more as a family and teaching you more.
Oh, please, don't get all regretful because of this. I can't deal with it. I hear my own voice oozing sarcasm and anger. Shame and guilt pummel me, but my anger is real too. I rise from my seat. I have to get ready. Violet's going to be here any second.
Maya?
The earlier tender tone in my mom's voice dissipates. Enough of these sarcastic remarks. You can go to the mosque and pray for the poor people who lost their lives.
You will go. That's final.
Fine. I'll play the devout daughter for you.
Maya!
My father yells, but I ignore him. If I don't leave now, I'll say things much worse than I already have. I take the stairs two at a time to get to my room. My bedroom door bangs shut. I grab the lamp from my desk and pull back my arm, ready to slam it into my reflection in the mirror so they can both shatter into a million pieces. I stop myself. Like everything else in my life right now, the act is pointless. The parking lot pulses with students who mill around, catching up. I'm sure they're talking about the terrorist, the Muslim terrorist. As I step out of Violet's car, I see Phil. He's at his car talking to his friend Tom, the one who's pushing for the perfect post-high school future at Eastern with Megan and Lisa, and a couple other teammates. Phil's in profile and half-hidden by one of his friends, but I see Tom laughing. Then Tom sees me. I wonder what it feels like to be so unaffected that you can laugh, even when horrible things are happening. Tom points his chin in my direction and mutters to Phil, who turns his head and waves. I hold up my hand in half-hearted response. I don't know why I bother. My lips pull down at the corners. Those three texts I got in French class were the last I've heard from Phil. Lisa and Megan bounce up to Phil and Tom. Lisa puts her arm through Phil's. Apparently, the rumors of their breakup were greatly exaggerated. I want to turn away. I should. Evidently, I'm a glutton for punishment. Let's go, Violet says to me as she frowns at Phil. We move through the parking lot and begin walking up the ramp to the school doors. From the corner of my eye, I see Brian. He's jogging toward us. I get a queasy feeling in my stomach. Instinctively, I speed up. When he's within earshot, he yells,
"Is that terrorist your uncle?"
He sounds gleeful and disgusted at the same time. There's a viscous, dreamlike quality to all of this. I turn to him. For a split second, I think maybe he didn't say what I thought he said. Maybe he's not talking to me. But who else could he be talking to? My mouth is wide open. My mind races to find a retort, but it's muddled. I've heard the words before. The taunts. I should know to expect them by now, but the words still cut. "Shut up, Brian," is all I manage to get out. Brilliant. I wish I were better under fire with scalding barbs. Not my strong suit. There is so much more to say. So much more I want to scream. I want to get in his face, to tower over him. But I'm a foot too short for that.
"Go to hell, Brian," Violet yells. "You fucking jerk." "Ooh, so touchy. Well, the terrorist has the same last name as Maya, doesn't he?"
"Yeah, and he's a sick asshole," Violet responds. "That's the thing you have in common." He grins. I can see how our words are like fuel that incites him further.
"Why don't you people leave America if you hate it so much?"
I wince, remembering the conversation I had with my parents. My own words spat back at me. "I was born here, you racist! And that guy was Egyptian! My family's Indian!" My temples throb. Why am I even explaining? I shouldn't need to explain. And it shouldn't matter where my family is from. But I do. And it does. A small crowd gathers around us, watching.
"Let's go, Maya. Ignore him."
Violet takes my elbow, but the anger courses through me. My feet are cemented in place.
Egyptian, Indian, what's the difference? You're both ragheads.